technical committee, it will be hard also to introduce Nancy Rigotti. Dr. Rigotti is one of the leading experts in the world regarding smoking cessation. She's the Associate Professor of Medicine at the Harvard Medical School, Director of the Massachusetts General Hospital Tobacco Research and Treatment Center. And she's going to address the question regarding an update in pharmacotherapy in 2007. Please, Nancy.
Thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here. It's been wonderful to have the opportunity to meet and learn from my European colleagues and to visit this wonderful city. And I have news for you, Jack. I was promoted this summer to professor, so now you need to take what I say more seriously. Okay. So what I would like to do today is to summarize the situation for pharmacotherapy, talking very much about the current situation, because I will be followed in the next lecture by a speaker who will speak about one of the future opportunities. Here's an overview of what I would like to cover. First, to cover the current guidelines for pharmacotherapy. Second, to review some new evidence that has come out since some of the guidelines were written, speaking specifically about two things. One is how to use older drugs more effectively, and the second is our new medications that are on the market or are maybe coming to the market or maybe not. And then the third, because we are here at a conference that focuses very much on how do we change population of quit rates and population use of tobacco, is to speak about what is the role of pharmacotherapy for improving cessation rates at the population level. So that's where we're going. Let's get started. First, quitting in perspective. I will show you some U.S. data. I think that it is very different in different countries, but I'm using it not because I only think about the U.S., but because it makes a point that is common for everyone. So first of all, in the U.S., we are in the lucky situation now that more than half of all adults who have ever smoked have quit. That's called the quit ratio. I know that it's a little bit lower in some countries, although I think it is approaching in some parts of Western Europe where we are in the States. Perhaps in some places it is higher. It is also true that in the United States, and I think in much of the world, that most current smokers would like to quit smoking. And it is true in the United States now that over 40% of smokers say that they have tried to quit in the last year and have gone at least 24 hours without smoking intentionally. That is the good news. The good news is that there are a lot of people who would like to quit and who are trying to quit. The bad news is that few succeed in the long term. And as you know, because of the problem of relapse, that we define success as having quit for an entire year. Mark Twain, who was a famous American humorist, spoke about this, and he said, "It's easy to quit smoking. I've done it 1,000 times." He, in fact, never did quit smoking. I read a biography of his recently, and he died of congestive heart failure prematurely. Here's the data on why people don't succeed. One reason why people don't succeed is that the success rate is not high, even with our best treatments. The data from the U.S. are that about 5% quit without any of those who quit without help are successful, compared to 30% roughly who quit with our best treatment. So that treatment clearly is effective. If we had better treatments, more people would quit and we need better treatments. But that is not the only problem. The other problem is that the treatments we have are not being used widely in the population. That in the United States now, only 20 or maybe 25% of smokers who try to quit actually use our existing treatments. So for people who are clinicians like myself, not scientists, what we can do is we can, I'm not going to be able to discover the next new drug, but what I can do is make sure that more of my patients who are smokers, who are interested in quitting, use the best treatments that are available, so that those of us in clinical or public health practice can improve cessation rates by getting more people to use the treatments that we have. That's the point of this slide. Okay, let's move on and talk about why it is that people continue to smoke once they have begun to start smoking. There are several reasons, and one of them, as you know, is that tobacco contains nicotine, and nicotine is clearly a drug capable of causing dependence, tolerance, and withdrawal symptoms when someone stops smoking. The common pathway in the brain is best understood is that nicotine activates dopaminergic neurons, which are located largely in the ventral tegmental area. They project forward to the nucleus accumbens and the prefrontal cortex, and that secrete anything that increases dopamine secretion in the brain is reinforcing, so that not only cigarettes but other drugs of abuse activate this pathway, and this is thought to explain the addiction. The role of nicotine in this is that these neurons have many nicotine receptors, especially subsets of nicotine receptors, and that's why nicotine is effective in helping people that's why nicotine is addictive, excuse me. So why is it that people continue to smoke? So when they stop smoking after the brain has gotten used to having nicotine, they develop a craving, a sort of hunger for nicotine, and they develop nicotine withdrawal symptoms, which are listed here, that are nonspecific and often misunderstood by smokers who do not realize that they are going through nicotine withdrawal. And they include irritability, anger, and impatience, restlessness, trouble concentrating, trouble sleeping, anxiety, depressed mood, and an increase in appetite. The time frame for withdrawal symptoms, nicotine has a short half-life, therefore the withdrawal symptoms begin within a few hours of the last cigarette. They peak at a couple of days after quitting, say 2 to 3 roughly, and then go down fairly rapidly, so that after a week they are much less, after several weeks they are much less. Craving is somewhat differently handled in the brain, and cravings last much longer than the nicotine withdrawal symptoms. But it is our understanding that nicotine withdrawal can explain many of the early relapses to smoking, but not all of the long-term relapses to smoking. In addition to pharmacologic nicotine dependence, smokers often also keep smoking because they are there's a habit part of smoking, a psychological factor that smokers begin are cued to smoking by finishing a meal, having alcohol, being around other smokers, and these lead people to be sort of have almost automatic responses of wanting a cigarette. In addition, smokers have learned from the time that they began smoking to use cigarettes to cope with stress, emotions such as anger, frustration, and boredom, and negative emotions to help handle, say, depressive symptoms. And for that reason, that's another reason why it is difficult to quit. Because smoking is a consequence of both pharmacologic and psychologic factors, it makes sense that a single medicine is not probably going to be the answer, that there will be always the context of what is the psychological context of the medication. I doubt that we will have a single magic bullet, although perhaps I am wrong. Now I'm going to turn to talking about pharmacotherapy. What I'm going to show you are the guidelines from the year 2000 in the United States. They are very similar to the guidelines, the various European guidelines that Dr. Batra showed us in the previous talk. The U.S. guidelines are currently being revised. They will come out in 2008, and they are currently in draft form that are available to download and comment on. So I'll tell you some idea of what they are, but these are not final, so please don't quote me. But the current guidelines will say that there are two classes of drugs for which smoking that have good evidence of efficacy for smoking cessation and are considered first line. These are widely available around the world: nicotine replacement and bupropion in the sustained release form, otherwise known as Zyban or Wellbutrin. Each of these roughly doubles quit rate compared to placebo, and the cessation rate are higher when counseling is added to drug treatment for the reasons that there's a psychological or habit component to smoking, although the drugs can be effective by themselves. Let's speak now about nicotine replacement. These are the products that are available. There are 6 products available, including the patch, the gum, the lozenge, the sublingual tablet, an inhaler, and a nasal spray. Again, the question is often which drug is most effective. The products have really been compared head-to-head only in a few studies, and perhaps the best was one that compared 4 of them and found them roughly equally effective at the end of, in a direct head-to-head comparison. In the individual comparisons, there are some differences in odd ratios, but it really, practically speaking, they're all roughly the same. The side effects, of course, differ by the mode of administration. With the patch, there are skin rashes. With the lozenge, their oral issues, so that it depends on how the nicotine is getting into the system. Let's turn now briefly to bupropion. Bupropion is thought to act by increasing dopaminergic activity through the pathway that I showed you earlier. It doubles the quit rate independent of its antidepressant effect. It is an antidepressant, an atypical antidepressant. It is not just that it takes depressed people, makes them feel better so that they can quit smoking. It, in fact, the activity for smoking seems appears to be, in fact, is independent of its antidepressant effect. The quit rates are higher if counseling is added, but just, I think, a week ago or two, there was a nice study in the Archives of Internal Medicine from a group in Italy showing that bupropion was very effective when used in the context of regular primary care practice, so that even with low levels of support, it is effective. The main concern with bupropion is that it lowers the seizure threshold, the risk being about 1 in 1,000. Now, since we have the two, the question is, well, which drug is better? This is the classic study that was done on this subject, and it was published several years ago. And what it shows us is that this was a study that compared them head to head. This is the one continuous abstinence level at 1 year. And in this study, bupropion was better than placebo. And the combination of bupropion and the patch was better than placebo. In this study, the nicotine patch was not better than placebo, even though there are dozens of studies showing that the nicotine patch is effective. Probably the reason for this is when, if you look at the date, it came out in, it was done in the late 1990s, right after bupropion entered the market in the United States. And so almost none of the people on bupropion had ever seen it before. They had not failed it. But at least half of the people on nicotine replacement had already failed nicotine replacement before, and that probably explains the difference between the two. There also looks like there may be a difference between the combination versus a single agent. And the p-value for this difference was not statistically significant, but close. So the conclusion of this one study would be that bupropion is better than nicotine replacement. The combination is safe and could be used if needed. This study was known at the time that the guidelines were put together in the United States, and the guideline panel chose not to use this one study and say bupropion is better, but rather to say bupropion and nicotine patch are roughly equal. And I present you the data and let you make your own decisions. There recently was a new study published in, I believe, Nicotine and Tobacco Research just this month or last month, showing that compared bupropion with nicotine gum. And in that study, the gum did not add any efficacy to bupropion. However, the use of the gum was not very high. So we don't really yet have any have convincing evidence. At least we don't have a replication of this one finding. Okay. We also have second-line drugs according to the U.S. Public Health Service guidelines. These are not approved for smoking cessation in the United States. One was clonidine, which I mentioned only to dismiss. It really is not used because of side effects in clinical practice. Nortriptyline, however, is an interesting one. It is a tricyclic antidepressant, as you know. It has the advantage in the United States of being a generic drug and therefore inexpensive. At the time of the guideline panels, they said, well, we don't have as many studies, and so we'll consider it a second-line drug. Since the guideline panel, there have been several new studies that have confirmed that it is efficacious, and I think that it is closer to being a first-line drug, although I believe that the new U.S. guidelines will not consider it that. But I think it is a reasonable alternative, and we have better data to suggest that it works. Okay. The guideline panel was also very helpful in telling us what doesn't work. And the evidence is that SSRI antidepressants, which are the common ones that are most commonly in use, do not seem to work for smoking cessation, and anxiolytics do not work. When patients come in saying that they want something to calm them down because they're anxious from quitting smoking, what they really are is in nicotine withdrawal and probably need more effective nicotine replacement or other pharmacotherapy, not something an anxiolytic. Now let's move on to the newer evidence, new ways to use old drugs and the new drugs. The new drug, the old drug I want to talk about is nicotine replacement. The purpose of this slide is to show you that not all nicotine replacement is the same, even though it's not, you would think at first blush that nicotine is nicotine no matter how it gets into the system, but clearly the way in which it gets in and the rapidity at which it enters the bloodstream makes a big difference. This is meant to show you, to compare for you, single dose of a cigarette, which gives you the highest rate of, the highest rate and quickest peak, because inhaling smoke is the best way to get nicotine into the blood and into the brain. So presumably this is the pleasure of smoking, the rise, and the fall is the triggers the withdrawal symptoms. The nicotine product that is quickest to peak other than a cigarette is the nasal spray, which peaks in 5 to 10 minutes. After that are the oral forms of nicotine, which are the gum, the lozenge, the tablet, and the inhaler, which is really an orally absorbed product, not a true inhaler. And they take 20 to 30 minutes and then fall. And then the patch, it takes several hours to reach peak, and so it's a very different kind of product. So the point is that you could combine or use these in different ways and that they have different advantages. So we have, first of all, the patch, which is a long-acting, slow onset. And then we have the short-acting, which are the oral forms and the nasal forms. And we can think about them differently. They have different advantages and disadvantages. The patch gives you a constant nicotine level that prevents withdrawal. It's the easiest to use. It gets the best compliance. But the user has no control of dose, so during the day, if he or she has nicotine withdrawal or urges, they really can't do anything. The advantage, on the other hand, of the short-acting is that the user controls dose. If they are feeling uncomfortable, they can take something in that will relieve that, although not as quickly as a cigarette. The downside of this is that the nicotine blood levels fluctuate more when it's used as a single product, and it requires more training to use properly than using a patch. And so it makes sense to consider combining them to use the patch as your base product, and then to add on the shorter acting products as needed. And that's the first of the new ways to use older drugs for which there is evidence but may not be approved for use, at least in the United States, by the Food and Drug Administration, which is a very conservative group. It is different here in Europe, where at least in the UK I know that there are much broader indications for these. So the first is to combine short and long acting forms of nicotine replacement. The second is to think about using higher patch doses. If you are a pack-a-day smoker and you use a 21 milligram patch, you are replacing only about 65% of your daily nicotine intake. That is why we can add the oral forms on top without causing nicotine overdoses, because there is this extra room. It's also true, if you think about it, that smokers are masters of modulating nicotine levels to make themselves comfortable. There really is not a nicotine drunkenness state. People don't abuse it to make themselves sick because they would throw up, it would be uncomfortable. What people who are addicted to nicotine do is they know how to modulate the levels to make themselves comfortable. And so we can dose the patches and have the patients help us to figure out what is the right amount. And so combining long and short acting forms is a way of doing that, and using higher doses can be more effective. Another approach is to extend the treatment to prevent relapse, rather than using just the 8 to 12 weeks, which is the current indication, to use it for longer periods of time. It's quite clear that if you extend the treatment, that more people at the end of treatment will be successful. Whether or not that will, when they stop the longer treatment, they will still stay stopped is not as clear. Another approach, which has been very interesting, is to start the patch before the quit day. I think this is a really interesting approach that it may become the standard if the current studies confirm the initial studies that we have seen. So traditionally, you stop smoking and then you start the patch. There are a couple of studies now that have suggested that if you start the patch 2 weeks before the quit date, that group has a higher quit rate than those who don't start the patch until the quit date. And finally, there's the paradigm of reduce to quit or gradual reduction, which is to take people who say, I want to quit, but I want to quit gradually as opposed to abruptly, and there is a growing body of evidence that this is also effective. So these are all a variety of ways of using nicotine replacement that are different, more creative, new compared to the traditional ways that we were taught, or at least I was taught, that we were all taught, and that in the UK, a number of these indications, specifically, I believe, reduced to quit and combining treatment, is now in the label indications. Okay, so that's the old drugs. Now I want to speak about the newer evidence. The new drugs that we might want to consider would be varenicline, cytisine, rimonabant, and the nicotine vaccine. I won't speak about the vaccine because our next speaker will tell us all about that. So I will speak about the first three. So first, varenicline. So this is the result of research underlying the subtleties of nicotine receptors. The bottom line is that all nicotine receptors are not alike in the brain, and that a particular subtype, the alpha-4 beta-2, appears to mediate nicotine dependence. And therefore, it is a potential target for a smoking cessation drug, because if you could target this receptor and not the other nicotine receptors, you could perhaps develop something that is good for smoking cessation that does not have the other side effects like increasing heart rate and blood pressure that raise questions about safety. And this is what varenicline did. A large pharmaceutical company developed varenicline, which binds selectively to the alpha-4 beta-2 nicotinic receptor. It binds more tightly than nicotine. And it has a dual mechanism of action. That is to say, it is a partial agonist. It has some of the effects of nicotine when it binds. It stimulates the receptor to beat craving and withdrawal. But because it binds tightly to the receptor, if a smoker smokes while they are taking this drug, the nicotine cannot bind, and so they do not get the reward or the reinforcement from smoking. So it has a potential double action, which makes it a very interesting pharmacologic compound. Well, the theory is quite interesting. What does the data tell us? This is showing you the results of two very large randomized controlled trials, each with over 1,000 patients each, which were done in the United States and published about a year ago. This shows the end of treatment results in the two trials, which are virtually identical. You see that in these trials, varenicline was superior to placebo. Bupropion was also superior to placebo, and in these trials, varenicline at the end of drug treatment was better than bupropion. But we know that relapse occurs at the end of drug treatment, so does this persist after a year? This shows the continuous abstinence rate through 1 year, which is a conservative measure of outcome. And you see that, the pattern holds that varenicline was superior to placebo, bupropion was superior to placebo, and in one of the two studies, actually in both, it looks like they are, that the varenicline is better than bupropion. In one, it was statistically significant, in the other, it was only marginal. But certainly suggests that it is at least as good as what we have, and perhaps better than bupropion. On the basis of this, varenicline was approved in the United States and has been approved across the European Union. The main side effect of this drug is nausea, which occurs in many patients, up to 30%, consistently across studies, although most of it's mild to moderate. And in the studies, only 3% of people stopped the drug because of nausea. Across the studies, across all side effects, about 7 to 8% of patients taking varenicline in the clinical studies stopped the treatment due to side effects. It's licensed for 12 weeks of treatment and 12 more. If someone has quit at the end of 12 weeks, there is an additional study, a relapse prevention study that was done in Europe that showed that you got somewhat higher quit rates if you continued for an additional 12 weeks. And as I said, it is approved for smoking cessation in the U.S. and the European Union. So we know a lot, but there's a lot we don't know because it's a new drug. So here's some things that we don't know. We don't know the efficacy without regular behavioral support. In the studies that were done, there was weekly 10-minute behavioral support every time someone came in. So how well will this drug work in clinical practice when we don't provide that level of behavioral support? There are some studies ongoing now that will answer that question, but we don't know yet. A second is that We don't know the efficacy and the tolerability of this in a broader spectrum of smokers than qualified to come into to clinical trials. To come into a clinical trial, a smoker has to be very healthy. How is it going to work in a patient with COPD, with cardiovascular disease, with other, or perhaps with depression? These people were not in those studies. The efficacy of varenicline is now being tested in a company-sponsored study in both cardiovascular disease and COPD, so we will have the answers there. I'm not aware that it's being tested yet in depression, in patients with depression. Are there very rare side effects? Certainly that's something that it's not until a drug has been in practice for a while that that will be found. It's possible. So far there's not a clear information, but we have to be thinking about that. We also don't know how efficacious this drug is compared to nicotine replacement. That's the biggest question that I'm always asked. We don't have the answer. And then we might think about, can we combine this with bupropion or with nicotine replacement? You might think that it makes no sense to combine it with nicotine replacement. I will say that we have been doing it and others have been doing it and sometimes finding it works, even though the theoretical rationale is a little hard to come up with. Finally, my judgment would be that it's a first-line drug. I don't think that it is the first-line drug that supersedes all others at this point, and I think that that's what the U.S. guidelines are likely to say. All right, the next new drug is cytisine, which is actually not a new drug, an old drug. It is also a nicotine receptor partial agonist that binds to alpha-4 beta-2. It was actually comes from Eastern Europe. It is from a plant extract. It was developed in Bulgaria in the 1960s. There were several trials in Germany done in 1960s showing that it worked, and it was used in Eastern Europe for cessation. It was sort of not widely known, at least in Western, certainly was not known in Western Europe and not known in the United States. It was sort of rediscovered by Jean-François Etter, who read the trials and did a nice meta-analysis that suggested that it might work. There was a Cochrane review that came out just this year. They said the existing evidence was limited and not of very good quality. There was one acceptable trial, and it had an odds ratio that looked like it was effective in the range of others. It may be helpful, but the evidence was inconclusive. Right now, there is a trial in Poland that is a collaboration between the UK and Polish investigators, so we will know more. The real potential for this drug is that it is low cost, and so therefore it might be available for low-income smokers and countries where really there are not resources to, say, purchase other alpha-4 beta-2 agonists. Let's move on now to rimonabant, which is a cannabinoid receptor antagonist. It was discovered as part of research on understanding how marijuana works in the brain. It turns out that marijuana binds to receptors and raised the question of what are those receptors there for. It turns out that the drugs which we are still learning what those receptors are there for and understanding new things about neurochemistry, but in the meantime, pharmaceutical companies have said, well, this is an interesting target. Rimonabant is a drug which decreases body weight, it decreases abdominal obesity, it increases HDL cholesterol levels, it reduces triglyceride levels, it increases insulin sensitivity, and increases glucose tolerance. It sounds like a drug for all people. We should put it in the water. It would treat obesity, it would treat diabetes, it would treat a metabolic syndrome, and I think that for a while people thought this was going to be the drug for everything. It is approved in the EU for obesity. It is not approved in the United States for anything. And the US FDA recently rejected a request for approval on the basis of concerns about side effects, specifically neuropsychiatric side effects, especially depressive side effects that came up rarely, but the concern was of safety. You must understand that this was done, that the political context for the Food and Drug Administration right now is extremely conservative because of several very embarrassing things that have happened there with other drugs, and so they're going to be very conservative going forward. But does it work for smoking cessation? Here is the result of one study of several that have been done. This is the Stratus US study, which compared rimonabant to two doses of rimonabant to placebo. At the end of treatment, you see that the higher dose of rimonabant was superior to placebo and at long-term abstinence, it was also superior to placebo. The other thing that was found in this study that made it particularly interesting, because although it was better than placebo, it wasn't that much better. It looked like it was kind of roughly what we had, if not even that good, was that this looks at weight loss among those who quit smoking. In the placebo group, there's the standard several kilogram weight gain, whereas in the higher dose rimonabant group, there was almost a suppression of weight gain, which made it of considerable interest to people who might be concerned about weight gain. Unfortunately, the drug trials for rimonabant are not published yet. So what I'm telling you is comes from a poster that was published that was presented last year at the SRNT meeting in Europe. And there was a pooling of the data from three randomized trials, and they showed that smoking cessation efficacy at end of treatment was about an odds ratio of 1.6 that was statistically significant, and the sustained abstinence was also statistically significant, although not something to jump up and down about, since we usually think that drugs should double quit rates. The weight gain in quitters was clearly suppressed across all the trials, but as I said, it is not approved for smoking cessation at this time. I wanted to tell you about one other trial that we did and also presented last week at the SRNT meeting in Europe, as well as at the one in Texas before that, showing that when you add the nicotine patch to rimonabant, you essentially double the quit rates that you get with rimonabant. This is not surprising. Nicotine patches work. What was interesting about this study is that you maintained the suppression of weight gain. So we have a number of, will rimonabant go forward? I don't know. The safety questions remain to be seen. So which drug to choose? Well, thinking about that, efficacy is one consideration. Varenicline has been better than bupropion in two of two studies, but those were both done by sponsored by the pharmaceutical company. We don't have an independent study. Bupropion maybe is better than NRT in one of two studies. I don't think that we have convincing data. And we don't know about varenicline versus NRT. So I think that we don't really have the data to say that there's a best drug at this time. In terms of another consideration for an individual patient is any medical contraindications. And then so that in the end, it's often a matter of patient preference, what they have tried before, because many people have tried things before, and whether they work for them. So in my final point was to really talk about how we can, the role of smoking cessation to improve smoking cessation in the population. One strategy is we could improve the success of smokers who try to quit. We could develop new drugs, or we could tailor treatment to smokers, such as Dr. Batra was beginning to talk about in the behavioral side of things. We could tailor treatments to smokers, and one of the areas of great interest now is looking at pharmacogenomics, which means that what you do is you sort of identify what are the genetic components of people who do better with one drug versus the other, and perhaps in the future we will be doing some genetic tests on smokers to see, well, for you, probably this drug A is better, for you, drug B is better. We're not there yet, but there's considerable interest in research in this area. We also need to deliver better ways to deliver treatment to smokers who are quitting, and this is not just from doctors, this is through quit lines and websites and many other public health things. Finally, we need to increase the proportion of smokers who try to quit. Tobacco control policies of the types that are discussed here denormalize smoking, and the new treatments are also encouraging, and as new treatments come, they also encourage smokers to quit. So I thank you. I leave you with a final thought about tobacco use as being something that takes constant treatment, and I will stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for a very great